Good morning. Come on in. There's room in here. There's room in here. So in the last talk I gave, I talked a little bit about Buddhist... Hi, come on in. Have a seat. About the origin of Buddhism. Come on in. There's room in here. Have a seat. There's a door still opening up, closing there. So maybe I'll wait till this last person comes in. Oh. Well. Okay, well, I guess we'll just sit here for a minute and breathe. So, original Buddhism really was about, as original Buddhism is still about, creating a counterculture. We can think of Buddhism in India as a civilizing agent. At a time when the caste system was so rigid. And according to my daughter-in-law, who's Indian, instead of the 16 castes that we think of, there were more like the six castes that we think of. There were more like 18 castes, and that there still are in an informal kind of way. And of course, Buddhist teaching was in a gentle way, totally counter to that. He said everybody has the still nature. Everyone can wake up to the still nature. And the people who I ordain to work with me on manifesting this still nature can be from any caste. It's totally irrelevant. And it's totally irrelevant because we're all interconnected. And it's not a hierarchy of interconnection. It's a circle. It's a spiral of interconnection, not a hierarchy. So it's a more radical teaching, this counterculture that Buddha proposed in 500 and something before the contemporary era, than even the Jesus' counterculture. Because Jesus' counterculture was, do unto others as they will do unto you. But Buddha's counterculture is others and you. You and others. Where's the line? You're all one interpenetrating whole. So that's our counterculture. Present as the core value and being of Buddhist practice. And one of the first fellows to bring Buddhist practice to the U.S. was a guy named Nyogen Senzaki, even before my teacher Suzuki. He was just known for this little aphorism, my gladness is your gladness. I have no other gladness than that. I have no other gladness than that. And we could extend that to your sadness is my sadness. Your anger is my anger. And when I am with you in that, when I'm really with you, when we're with each other, there's a deep joy and a deep quietness underlying that. So that's our practice. That's what Zen practice is. And we get this practice in us through changing our cognitions about who we are. We no longer feel that we're dominated so much by the fear body. We're not dominated by it. We begin to let go of the fear body and develop some resilience. Some resilience. We do this through by imbibing. I like the word imbibing Buddhist teaching. Rather than just thinking about it, we take it into our pores, and then of course we meditate. We meditate. And gradually we change our biochemistry. As we change our beliefs and our attitudes. So, original Kalman culture in India, then in China, Tang Dynasty, 700 through 900, 700 through 1,000, 6th century through 9th century, a counterculture in China, a counterculture which was flourishing with wonderful Zen teaching, wonderful Buddhist teaching of interconnectedness and joy and sense of appreciating just the common, just the ordinary, just the most mundane. Hanshan, to learn where the wild ducks fly, follow the white hare banner. Find a magic melon in your dream. Steal a sacred orange from the palace. Far away from your native land, swim with the fish in a stream. So to imbibe this counterculture, we have to move far away from our native land, from our entrenched fear body, and swim with the fish in the stream, in the lake, in the pond, in the rivulet coming down the hill here to the Zen Center. Just swim with it. So that counterculture which started in India, then moved to China, and then it began to peter out first in India as it became part of the dominant culture. It took on the dominant culture's fear body. Seems like all dominant cultures, maybe there's some exceptions, have a fear body as their corpus. It's their corpus. So all of Zen then moved to Japan. Because in China, by about the year 1000, 1100, 1200, what was happening? The Buddhism was getting socially accepted. Buddhist monasteries had a lot of land. They had a lot of money. The emperor became their best friend. Watch out. Watch out. So then we have Dogen in Japan, and in the year 1220 something, there's Buddhism in Japan, but he feel like the people have not imbibed this counterculture. They haven't opened up to their natural stillness. They haven't let go of all of their worries and concerns that create this armor of fear. So it's so dense, it's so heavy, we can't trust anyone, we can't trust anything. So he thought he would go back to China, where the original Buddhism was, to see if he could discover that counterculture still being alive in China, as he had read it, and as he had tried to practice it in Japan with others. And so he went to China, and in China in the 1200s, there was the dominant Buddhist culture was there, but there were still little enclaves of the counterculture, little enclaves of people practicing wholeheartedly, being with each other in stillness, compassion, and love, just practicing, meditating, reflecting on the teachings that the Buddhist teachers have, and imbibing them, taking them in. And so Dogen was there for a year and a half in China, a year and a half, and it was mostly not so good for him. not so good, because he saw all this stuff is pretty fake. These people are just talking about this stuff, but they're not living it. I don't see it when I'm with them. I don't feel it in my heart. And then when he was getting ready to go back to Japan, after he'd been in China for a year and a half, he happened to find, go up to Mount, whatever it is. I can't remember the name of it. Mount whatever it is. And he found Ru Jing, this old teacher who was practicing Zazen every day. Every day he practiced Zazen, morning and night. And he had imbibed the stillness of letting go of the fear body. Dogen could sense that about him. So Dogen stayed and practiced with him, and then attempted to bring back to Japan this counterculture that Ru Jing was passing on. And that's the sort of the beginning of Zen, as we know it, Soto Zen in Japan. So that's what we're about. That's what we're about. Creating a counterculture in the midst of a dominant culture, which doesn't necessarily, maybe shares our values outside, but inside is what we care about. Inside, the depth of your being and your heart, that's what we care about. We don't have enough leaders in the world who've really changed their biochemistry. The fear body is still dominating, isn't it? We put our faith in a leader, and then we see, oh, he or she too is stuck on the fear body. He or she too has lost their resilience. So we need to become the leaders. It's up to us. We can do it. Just like Dogen did it, just like Ru Jing did it, just like Han Shun did it. They were just regular people. Just regular people. So my first teacher, as those of you who know me know, was Suzuki Roshi. And Suzuki, from my point of view, maybe not from his close relative's point of view, because sometimes we show our worst face with our close relatives, but he had pretty much shed his fear body. He was pretty wonderful, pretty go with the flow. The story I have not told in a few years, and only a few of you I think have heard it, is when we had our Zenefit in San Francisco. We were trying to raise money for the first Zen monastery in the United States. This was the late 60s in California. This was actually 1966. Long time ago, huh? Before a lot of you were born. 1966. So we decided to have a Zenefit. And we rented the Fillmore Auditorium in San Francisco. And this was 1966 in San Francisco. So remember? I mean, if you don't remember, you've read about it, right? And we had the Grateful Dead and Big Brother and the Holding Company and Janis Joplin come. And it was, and I got over there. I didn't live in the Haight-Ashbury because I was not my scene, but I got over there, and it was full of people. It was full of people, and there were light shows. There were light shows all over the place, strobe lights all over the place, all kinds of odors. You can imagine what all the odors were, all the lights, and then people were dressed or undressed in various forms and regalia. Right? And of course, the huge sound. I mean, huge sound. Mol Suzuki was there. He was the guest of honor because because it was a Zenefit. We decided that catchy term. You know, we'd make it a Zenefit. And they were going to raise all this money to support our new monastery. So he was sitting right in the front by the huge speakers. The strobe lights were going down on him. Well, you get the scene? Oh, he's there. He's there. And then Katagiri, who's my teacher, who started this Zen Center, is also there. But Katagiri is a young man. He's just come from Japan. He hasn't practiced that long. He has just become a guiding teacher, or just become an independent teacher, just pass through. Or Suzuki's been practicing for years and years with this resilience practice, years and years. So Suzuki just looks like he's in his element. He's sitting up there just looking around at all the lights and smelling all the smells. Looks like he's kind of grooving on the whole thing. And Katagiri's over in the shadow just looking really scared, shitless. I mean, like, what is going on here? What are we doing? And then, so, you know, the Big Brother and the Holy Company and the Grateful Dead, I don't remember too much, except that I remember finally Janis Joplin got up to say. Janis Joplin got up to say. And she was, of course, right in front of Suzuki. I mean, so, as Janis Joplin did, and as she still does, if you listen to her, she just gave it her all. She completely gave it her all. I mean, talk about shedding the fear body. Talking about being naked in front of thousands of people. Bearing her heart, bearing her soul, and of course her voice. She did it. She did it. So she sang, she left, and then it was time for Suzuki to come up to the stage. So Suzuki came up to the stage after Janis Joplin. And he said, I think he gave a little bow, probably. And he said, at first, I think your way very different from ours. But now I see not so different. Not so different. And everybody, yay, yay, somersaults and dancing. So he had been really touched by her. He'd been really touched by her nakedness, by her shedding of her fear body, her being available, her giving her heart to all those people. Not so different. But Janis Joplin didn't have resiliency. She hadn't really practiced. She could do that in front of people, in front of a group as an entertainer, but she had no resiliency. And her end of her life was very, very tragic. Very tragic. Very tragic. This is practice in resiliency, is what we are doing. So that we can, maybe we could never quite share the fear body, can't quite shed it as much as Janis did in front of 100 people or 1,000 people, but we can learn that it's a suit of armor we only need when we're in danger, and we're not in danger that much of the time. We're in danger much less of the time than we think we are. We're in danger about 8%. I just made that up. 8% of the amount we think we are. So, how many of you saw Beasts of the Southern Wild? No, not very many of you. A few of you. So, Beasts of the Southern Wild, I'm not going to tell the story. I guess I have to tell a little bit of it, though, because most of you haven't seen it. Beasts of the Southern Wild is about a counterculture, about a counterculture down on the bayou near New Orleans. And great storms and floods and hurricane is passing through. So this little community, which is called the Bathtub, which is kind of a little counterculture on the edge of the bayou, is being tossed and turned and up. There was great upheaval by the storm. And the heroine is who? Hush Puppy. little six-year-old African-American girl who has incredible resilience. incredible resilience, incredible ability just to be there, regardless of what's happening, and just to go with the flow with this, all of this storm. And of course, the community around her is very resilient in this movie too. They are. They're a genuine counterculture. They're very resilient. They support her. They're with her. It's a little bit magical realism. Well, sometimes we need magical realism. Sometimes we need magical realism. My grandson, I have two grandsons. One of my grandsons, who's very, very sweet, was a very warm-hearted boy. Boys are not always that warm-hearted. Very warm-hearted, very loving, very affectionate, but he's not very resilient. His brother is quite resilient. And some of us are just more natural. We just come out more naturally resilient than others. He didn't come out that resilient. That's just some of us innately have more resilience, and some of us have less. But just because we have less resilience, maybe that's better, because there's more opportunity to practice. There's more opportunity to really see the limitations of our fear body, and more motivation to work with ourselves, open our heart mind, and do practice. So my grandson Logan gets a lot of attention from his mama because he's not so resilient. And his mama is always, when we went to the park down by the lake, his mama said, "Logan, when the shadow is behind the slide, then we have to go home." And she keeps reminding him that every 5 minutes. "Logan, see, the shadow is moving." Well, why does she do that? Because she's learned if he doesn't remind him, he'll have a crying tantrum in the middle of the park when it's time to go. So always she is teaching him resilience, in a kind way, trying to be kind, not always kind. You know, sometimes we're not. I try to teach Zen, but I'm not very kind. And then you just learn about my own vulnerability, my own frailty. But she's teaching him resilience. So because he doesn't, if he's into something, he wants to stay into it. He doesn't believe in change. It's not one of his core values. His core value is when you find something good, stick with it. But he has to change his core values if he's going to live in this world. And his mama's helping him, and his grandpa's trying to help him too. Everything changes, Logan. In a few minutes, it's going to be like this. And when the shadows come like this, then we'll do that. "Oh, really, Mama?" "Yeah." "Oh, here it is. Time to go." Well, then he goes. How many prompts did we have to give him? How many times did we have to remind him of the shadow moving on the slide before he was calm enough so that he could just go when we said it was time to go? But this is human beings. This is the teaching for us as adults. As 20 years old, or 40 year old, or 60 year old, or 80 year old, the teaching, the Buddhist teaching, is to remind ourselves about just settling into what is, and waiting, and being available for whatever is going to happen, without clinging to the fear body, because the fear body ultimately lets us down. It protects us for a little while, and then we become so hard, so brittle, so alienated. It's so hopeless. So we have an opportunity in our practice to either strengthen the fear body or let go of the fear body. Partly through our zazen, through our meditation, but also through our interpretations of difficult experiences. And our beliefs about difficult experiences, our interpretations and our beliefs, the beliefs that we carry around that reinforce our negative interpretations. So when Susan was talking last week, someone was in the audience was saying, talking about being cut off in traffic. Oh, yes, here's being cut off in traffic. Okay. I'm cut off in traffic. You're cut off in traffic by someone. And then we're trying to get home. Oh, that idiot was so rude and selfish. That's my interpretation. So rude and selfish. My belief is I can't let folks get away with that. Doing this to me. What am I going to do? Maybe tailgate them? I haven't done that since I was a teenager, but tailgate them. Or maybe something else. And that strengthens my fear body and empowers my fear body. But what's resilience practice? Resilience practice, our interpretation is empathic. The guy is an idiot comes up, but then... I open my heart. I still my mind. Oh, he's anxious. He must really be out of sorts. He must be really having a hard time. It's no different than me. He's out of sorts. He's having a hard time. He's anxious. He's trying to get somewhere. He wants to be something. So I'm practicing resilience. I settle into just realizing that he's in the same situation I am. And as I become pissed at him, I'm just also entering into his world. But I'm empathic, I don't need to cultivate my own anger. I don't need to feed it. I can just see it and let it go. And so instead of a belief, I can't let people get ahead of me, cut me off like that, I got to call the cops or something, whatever it is. It's he and I are together. Like the Beatles said, that was that counterculture that didn't ever really take hold that I talked about last time from the Walrus. You are he as you are me, and we are all together. You are he and you are me, and we are all together. That's really what this teaching is about. But it's not about sort of talking about it. It's about trying to live it. Doing your best moment by moment to live it. And then you'll discover that it's actually true. That it's not something made up. It doesn't come out of some drug experience. It just comes out of natural empathy with things as they are. Things as they are. And that takes a lot of commitment to work on that. But we have Buddhist teaching. Got lots of teaching to help us. Lots of stories about teachers like Dogen I was talking about, like Hanshan, like Buddha. Stories about how they let go of the fair body. How they develop resilience. Story that I just told you about Suzuki Roshi. Maybe that's just a story. I mean, that's what I saw and that's what I remember. So I tell you that story to encourage you. Right? Katagiri later came here, became a wonderful teacher, but that was after many, many more years of practice. So Katagiri, he was the young Japanese one who was in the corner of the Fillmore Auditorium looking freaked out. He became a wonderful teacher here because he imbibed the teaching. He got it in him. That takes a long time. But on the other hand, it doesn't take any long. Little by little, you do it. Moment by moment, you do the whole thing. So it takes a long time, but it only takes a moment. It only takes a moment because it's this moment. That's when we can practice it. Only on this moment. We can't practice it on any other moment. Just know. So, we need to use our imagination. We need to imagine we can actually let go of the fear body and be resilient. Without imagination, without stories from Buddha, from about Suzuki Roshi, about Katagiri, about whomever, without teachers, without Shakespeare, without Blake, without Gandhi, without Martin Luther King, without Yolkon. We have no inspiration. And we don't believe we can do it. But we can do it. We can do it. That's what those stories are all about. I had two sisters close to me in age, and we all learned to swim in California, where I grew up. But my sisters were like tadpoles. They could just go in the water, and they were like tadpoles. And I was older than them, and I was not happy about this. They were resilient in water. You know how some kids are just shh. But I was not resilient in water. Every time I saw water, fear of body. I'm going to die. Right? I don't know if any of you remember that, but I remember it, especially because everybody else swam in my family. Fear of body. So my mother and my swimming teacher both worked more with me than my sisters. They didn't need to work with my sisters, so I got all the help in kind of imagining how I could be comfortable in water, in imagining how I could take my hippo tube in the water with me and what a good time we could have. Imagining how, even though my hippo tube lost the air, as it seemed to do, because they were clandestinely taking the air out of it all the time, the hippo would still protect me. My mother and my teacher, my swimming teacher, telling me stories about how my hippo and I together, I learned to swim that way, right? That's how I learned to swim. So we're learning to swim in this big, chaotic ocean, this big ocean with all of these different ebbs and flows and currents. It's the same thing, and our teachers are helping us. Encouraging us. And sometimes we just say, oh, God, I just want to get out of this water. Or I just want to get back in a boat and never see the water again. And that's okay. Sometimes we just need to be in the boat. Sometimes there's a jellyfish out there that might hurt us. So we need to get in the boat and put on their fear body to protect ourselves. Yeah, cool. We need the fear body. But the ocean is more than just man-o-war jellyfish, you know. It's more than that. It's wonderful. Spacious. All beings are communicating and interpenetrating in that ocean. Living. Dying. Enjoying each other. So what happens in imagination makes us who we are. That's why if you're not resilient, if you're not a good meditator, it doesn't matter. I was the worst swimmer. Now I'm the one in my family who likes to swim every day. Well, I don't like swimming in pools, but every day in the ocean I like to swim if I'm by the ocean every day. Because I had a teacher and a mama who helped me imagine living in a different way, living in the water. Now I'm actually as comfortable in the water as I am on air. And my wife says, oh, he's more comfortable in water. We'll just let him stay in the water. It's interesting, isn't it? Interesting. So what happens in our imagination? And we are lucky we have this imagination, aren't we, as human beings? Too often Zen teachers diss the imagination. But the imagination is wonderful. It makes us who we are. As Yeats says, in dreams begin responsibilities. In dreams begin responsibilities. Our responsibility to replace the fear body with the body of resilience. Without getting all agitated about it. Oh, it's still there. No, it's still there. It takes a while. You have to do it again and again and again. Again and again and again. Over and over and over. But can't we dream together that we can shed the fear body and that we can know wonderful resiliency? Can't we dream that together? Shall we dream that together? Shall we dream it and shall we actualize that dream? Shall we do that? So Lin Chi, called Rinzai in Japanese, Lin Chi said, "Bring the man or woman of naked red flesh forth. Bring the naked woman or man of red flesh forth." So acknowledge and accept without judgment or anger at the other driver. Acknowledge and accept that when I'm cut off, this comes up. Acknowledge and accept my own anger. Acknowledge and accept it. And when the moment I acknowledge, accept my own anger, I let the naked red flesh come forth, I'm able to practice empathy. I'm able to practice it. And it's not that even I'm practicing empathy. It just comes out. And of course, if you don't have a sitting practice, it's very hard to do this. And even if you have a sitting practice, it's not easy to do this. But you can do it. You can do it. So when we say our chant at the end, we vow to free all beings. And that's to imagine bravely, to imagine deeply that we can do this, that we can transform our thinking. Transform even our biochemistry. So maybe the best opportunity for me or for you after morning zazen, I do morning sitting for myself, which I've done for many years, and then I'm on my way to work and driving to work from here. I leave here, usually go to work. Maybe the best opportunity for practice is what? Is for me to be cut off every morning when I get on the freeway. To be cut off every morning. That's the best opportunity. I've done my zazen here. I've supposedly let go. I've opened up. And then I get over there on the freeway and that, whatever it is, guy cuts me off again. He's always there, you know. He's there, always there. Comes up every, you know. He cuts me off. Just to see how the fear body comes up. How it immediately wants to strike out. Just to breathe into that, and then to be empathic both with my own fear body and the driver's fear body. They're not two. Because he and I are together. They're not two. They're not two. So that's how we do this. We try to create a counterculture here by Lake Calhoun in our lives, at home. But this is a counterculture that is being passed on to us, that was created hundreds of years ago. Hundreds of years ago. And it never dies. The dominant culture never seems to really manifest it. Maybe someday the dominant culture will. And I'm not talking about Buddhism. If you think I'm talking about Buddhism, you're missing my point. I'm not talking about an ism. People fight about isms. Isms are all about fear bodies, you know. This fear body's ism, that fear body's ism. So your gladness is my gladness. Your sadness is my sadness. And your anger is my anger. And underneath there's a deep joy in just being with that. That's a joy that doesn't belong to anyone. That's a joy that you can't read about. That's a joy that doesn't even know it's joy. So that's what I want to say this morning, and I'll be glad to entertain questions or comments or stories or whatever. In the back, sure.
You were talking about how different countries, like you were talking about India or China, have a deer body kind of at its core, and how Buddhism relates to that. Can you talk a little bit more about what you meant?
So could you guys hear him? Okay, can you say that louder?
Yeah, so you were talking about how I believe it was India or perhaps China has kind of at its core of its identity a fear body.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were talking about how Buddhism either takes that over or does never quite succeeds in dealing with that fear body. And I wasn't quite sure how Buddhism relates to that fear body of it.
Well, what I think is that that most societies that perpetuate themselves, that become dominant in the world, have a fear body as their a body of fear that perpetuates their identity. And I'm not singling out China and India. On the contrary, I'm saying most nation states have a fear body as the underpinning for their existence, whether they know it or not. That's what I'm saying. But I'm saying also that there's an alternative to that. An alternative that I don't know when it started. We could say it started in India with Buddha, because Buddha presented an alternative, lived a different way, and lived with his community in a different way. Chuangzi in China was a Taoist, lived a different way. A way which was resilient, a way which was open, a way which was joyfully connected to everything. And that those countercultures usually don't become dominant, and when they turn into the dominant culture, whether they're the teachings of Christ or the teachings of Buddha or the teachings of Lao Tzu or Chuangzi, they tend to lose their vitality, and so people want to protect them, so they become part of a fear body. And I'm saying that all we can do is individually and collectively in our little sanghas, in our little communities, whether we're down in the bayous of New Orleans or here by Lake Calhoun or in our little family, do our best to be aware of when we get caught by the fear body. Do a meditation practice which helps us see and let go of the fear body, and begin to incorporate different interpretations of our experience, which are more empathic. And someday, maybe some counterculture could become a dominant culture, but it hasn't happened yet, I don't think. Does that help you or not? Okay. Yeah.
Do you think the Daily New York Times front page represents a fear body?
Do I think the Daily... Did you guys hear what she said?
Yeah.
Well, that's a very interesting question. What do you think?
I think it is, because I have gotten to a point where, you know, I pick it up on the front porch and then I open it, and there's so many really sad things in it, and bad things, and really fearful things.
Uh-huh.
That I think that's what it is.
Uh-huh. Well, that may be the case. I think that may be the case. Nevertheless, the New York Times is trying to tell it the best it sees it, trying to tell things as they see it. So we could... I'll just defend the New York Times for a moment. I'll say that New York Times is reflecting back to us what those journalists see and hear and feel. so that we'll be aware of this predicament that we've gotten ourselves in.
It's better to know rather than not to know.
I think so. I think so. However, there's an exception to that too. We can be, too much negativity, and we lose our even feeling that we become resilient. We become just, so I can't say that whether you should read the New York Times or not every morning. I read it once a week myself. That's about all I can take. I read it on Sunday. But, you know. Other people. Yeah.
Wouldn't the Department of Homeland Security be an embodiment of our country's body of fear?
Ah. Did you hear what he said?
No.
Well, what do you guys think?
I think so.
Uh-huh.
I might even call it the Department of Insecurity.
Good, good. Did you hear what he said? He said the Department of Homeland Security should be called the Department of Insecurity. Good. Good. Yeah, I agree. I agree. And the way in the back there.
What would your feeling be the natural connection to the fear of body and trauma? As far as what your feelings would be on how to acknowledge, you know, certain traumas one has had in their life and moving past, or what would be your feelings upon kind of using the getting away from fear of body in regards to those issues?
Could you guys hear him? Yeah, well, that's a good question, but there's no real... My answer isn't different than my answer is about people who haven't had trauma. It's the same thing. It's just what I've been talking about. If you've had a specific trauma, we could say it's going to be a little harder for you. We've been reading a lot about the traumatized vets, haven't we? More than we want to, and how PTSD is so prominent in their lives. So their fear body is a little more rigid, a little more crippling. They need all the coaching, all the love, all the practice in meditation and being in touch with their own naked flesh, with the trauma when it comes up, empathy, with everything I'm saying, they need. It's no different. They need. We all need them. But they probably need a little extra coaching. Yeah.
I don't know if this makes any sense, but it just popped in my mind. Sometimes when people lose heart, that they could be resilient and maybe overcome them. But your body feel connected to others, it's easier for them to connect to animals. For whatever reason, animals can maybe build a bridge that other people aren't able to.
Wonderful, Stephanie. Did you hear what Stephanie said? Well, Stephanie said that some people who are really caught by their fear bodies and afraid of other people, they do well with animals. And they really feel a connection with animals. And that's the way that should be a form of their practice. That should be their Zen practice. Not should with capital S, but small s. Wow, opportunity to be with cats, to be with dogs, to breathe with them, to pet them, to have them lick you. Yeah, the animal becomes your hippo raft. Exactly. Exactly. Your hippo raft.
Animals know better how to do this than you're teaching them.
Well, in a way, they do, I guess. I mean, that's always argued. People are always arguing. Oh, do animals have the Buddha nature? You know, a lot of debates in China. Do the dog have Buddha nature, right? But I'm an animal guy myself, so I say yes. Yeah.
My car, behind another car, and in this car there are two people, a man was driving a woman in the passenger seat, and there was this big dog right between them. And as we sat at the red light, the man kissed the dog about 5 times. And then the woman had him, and I thought, who, you know, does the dog need that? We're the ones that the human beings that needed that. And then my other thought was, I hope that man, you know, does that to people as well. You know, can he get that same effect to people?
Really? And
it wasn't me, was it?
So joyful for me to witness that.
Uh-huh. That's great. My wife and I have a cat now that we got when it was a little kitten and it was homeless. And that cat is, we've had that cat for maybe a year, year and a quarter. Well, so that cat needs Linda and I to help it serve its role that it's supposed to serve in our family, which is to be the hippo, which is to be the companion. But so we're continually practicing with that cat how to approach it quietly, how to maybe get one little pet in before it runs off. And this morning I got 3 pets in. So that sooner or later it will give back to me. And it will. We had another homeless cat, and that homeless cat, it took about 8 years. Took about 8 years, but after 8 years, you know, just a lap kitty, just all over us. But this is exactly the same as Zen practice. This is human practice. It takes a while. You don't, please don't give up. It takes a while, moment after moment, and you will discover a wonderful calmness that isn't your own, and that just is there even with all this change, with all this havoc, with all this stuff human beings have been doing to each other for since they seem, I guess they began. I don't know. Time for one more? Sure.
Pope Francis.
Uh-huh. Well. Okay. Do you want to say something about him? Yeah, well. It looks pretty wonderful at the moment, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. We don't know, but it looks pretty wonderful at the moment. We don't know. It's almost too good to be true at the moment. Do you think so? Do you agree with me or not?
Sounds like your fear bias.
Yeah. Exactly. And my fear body. You know, I'm waiting for the New York Times next weekend to see the real scoop about Pope Francis. The real deal on him. Right? Okay, well, thank you very much, and I think I'll turn it over to the Dawn now.
Thank you for coming.